Hi, this is Bruce Ryder, Five Finger Death Punch, and you're listening to the Jay Franzi Show.
Welcome to the Jay Franzi Show, a behind-the-curtain look at the entertainment industry with insights you can't pay for and stories you've never heard. Now, here's your host, Jay Franzi.
Well, hello and welcome to the show. I am Jay Franzi, and this is your backstage pass to the entertainment industry. This week, we get to talk with an amazing musician and songwriter. We get to talk with Drew Phillips. We'll talk to him about his time in Pay the Girl, what it was like to be on the road with Shakira, and his current project, Big Mood. Now, my connection to Drew is kind of funny because his daughter is best friends with my daughter, and they insisted that we meet because of our backgrounds in the music industry. So, well, we did, and now Drew is one of my best friends. He's traveled an amazing path, and I can't wait to talk to him about it tonight. So if you would like to join him, comment, or fire off any questions, please head over to jfranzi.com. Now let's get started. Drew, sir, how are you?
Doing good, Jay Franzi. How's it going, man?
It's good to have you here, my friend. It is good to have you. I would like to jump in. What inspired you to get into the music business in the first place?
Oh, man. It's hard to talk about like getting into music without talking about I have an identical twin brother. When you're in Twin Town, you're always sharing everything as everyone can imagine. We'd pull our like allowances together and things to figure out, you know, are we going to buy G.I. Joe or are we going to buy a record? And so we would go and build this collection together. I think that actually built a lot of foundation because, you know, it was an experience that we shared. And then I remember at an early age deciding, like, I'm going to play guitar and you're going to play drums. You know what I mean? And that's what we did. And then from there, just played in bands all the way up through college. And that was the beginning.
Does your brother still play anything these days?
Yeah, he plays a little bit. He's in Pittsburgh now. He's a drummer. Actually, he got me involved in audio recording.
Very nice. So what was the first big thing, first project you took on?
I would say in college. My twin brother's name's Adam. We went to Ohio University together. One of the first things that we did in college was start a band with some good friends, kicked around the bar scene. And then I was in the College of Communications there at OU.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Which was great because they had a studio there and we would get in at night getting some free studio time. We went in there, did some projects, and ended up cutting our first CD.
Do you still have that CD today?
Yeah, I do. I probably have a box if you want to know, or six.
So that CD, did you do anything with it at the time?
So we put it out and we sent it out to a bunch of record labels and did what most bands do that are trying to do something with their music. And oddly enough, when we graduated from college, we had a decision to make. We literally went to Los Angeles to start to look for places we were going to get out of Ohio, you know, and go do that because that's the dream.
Right.
And we had that commitment pretty early on. Although, ironically, there was an independent record label in Dayton, Ohio, that liked it.
All places.
Yeah, and so it's like, well, so you imagine we're in Los Angeles looking for a place to go, but then the record label says, hey, I like what you're doing. Let's cut another record. You know, here's your budget. So we stuck around, and after college, moved to Cincinnati. That's how I got here.
So how long did that last, the band with your brother?
So 4 years of college, and then another year after that. Moved to Cincinnati, and then I think we were together, I'd say 2 more years.
Really?
And we did a independent record, played around town, and then that's sort of where my career trajectory took a left turn.
Took a turn.
Yeah.
Well, where did it take you?
There was a singer-songwriter at OU named Jason Phelps. He was working with a management company out of Cincinnati. who was managing a band called Blessed Union of Souls.
Yep.
And so Blessed Union of Souls had, they had a top five single, they had a top 20 single, and four top 40s on top of that. So probably the biggest pop band in Cincinnati at the time. They had been on it a while, and their guitar player was looking for a replacement to do the road gigs. And so my friend Jason, we're friends with these guys, and he called me. He's like, hey, got this thing. You might want to check it out. You might want to try out. And so that's exactly what I did.
And how'd that go?
It was, again, a good experience. It was one of those situations where, like, yeah, this will work. And they took me, well, the guitar player who I was replacing said, just meet us at the band offices and just come on the road with us. Yeah, just do and it. Then we'll rehearse at soundcheck. So, and that's literally how it went. So I guess for me, it's like figuring out what the mystery of the music business was a big goal. Like, is it what you imagine when you're a kid listening to records in your bedroom? And what is it really like? Well, this was, I guess, the next step into like sort of devolving the mystery of what it is. So I end up meeting them downtown, and the big tour bus pulls up, and it's like, this is Drew, this is the band, get on the bus, go to the first gig. Yeah, literally.
And it's a little different than playing some regional bars and stuff.
So. Yeah, and just meeting the guys. And I can't remember where the first gig was. I think it was in West Virginia somewhere. So we go there, and then sound check comes around. They do the check. I get on stage, take his guitar. We start to run through a couple songs. And then they did the show, and then we did that a couple more times on a couple more runs.
And when you landed that gig, what was going through your mind?
If I'm being really honest, there's always the element of imposter syndrome. It's like,
of course.
You know what I mean? So it's like, well, I'm going to find out real quick. But it was also really exciting. They had a crew. They had a road manager. Kind of understand what that relationship was like. And honestly, how cool all those guys were and how supportive they were. Like, oh, new guy, you know?
Right.
I learned a lot from that. But it was a really good time. And then it culminated into a gig in Wisconsin. We were playing the Wisconsin State Fair, and the band was playing. And, you know, we had done all the sound check. And then the guitar tech, his name's Tom Weber. He's kind of a local legend. He's tech for EVH and, you know, all kinds of people. Really great guy. He just, you know, signals me over to the guitar world, throws the Les Paul Special on me and says, go play the encore with them. You know what I mean? And it was a Buddy Miles song, Them Changes. So super cool. So that was my first, you know, 5,000 people going nuts. It was just a good time. And it was a short run with those guys, because the next chapter of that story goes, Jason, the songwriter that I'd met at OU, who was here, signed with the same management company, was starting a band.
Right.
And then he asked me if I wanted to try out for that. So I did. And that ended up being Pay the Girls.
Pay the
Girls. Yeah. So.
All right. So that was a big one.
Yeah.
So you auditioned at that point. Did you know it was big at that time?
So I knew what the management company was capable of.
Right.
Having cultivated a top 10 band. It was really exciting at that time, because I love Jason Phelps. He's a great songwriter, incredible singer. And it was kind of cool because it was going to be a band. You know, it wasn't going to be, right. Well, I guess necessarily. I mean, the guy's the songwriter. He's the guy.
Right.
You know, he's the guy. So, and honestly, they had a lot of those songs written for that project. But I was really excited about coming in and kind of building the band up around playing guitar. And then there's a lot of misadventures that happened along the way of that project.
Well, that's what I want to know.
Yeah.
So what was the first thing that happened with that band? You go in, you rehearse, you become familiar with everyone.
Yeah, I guess a few things had happened. So they had already recorded probably more than half of a record. And I guess that happens a lot. So the songs were there. They were looking for players to be a live band at that point. And the idea was to get a deal,
right?
Which is where we ended up. So band was put together. We were rehearsing a short show. And then, you know, a year later, let's say, I can't remember how long it was, then it was, you know, time to showcase. So We went to SIR in Nashville, you know. So, you know, at each point of this, it's like there's just another layer to the I guess pressure, but more like experience gaining, confidence building.
As you're going along, you're building up that confidence with it.
So. Yeah. And then like rehearsals and things was pretty intense. We had a lot of oversight. You know, there's people putting money behind you, trying to build the thing. And so, yeah, we did, I think I can remember 5 or 6 different showcases, SAR, gigs in town. And honestly, that was a really mortifying experience for me because, and I should say the band, but I'm just going to speak for myself here. But because if you imagine, if you're playing a gig, you know, there's a symbiotic thing happening with a crowd. At SIR, you're set up full production, literally 2 guys in suits walk into the room and do this while you play your show.
Yep.
You know, it was something else. Not what I was used to.
So let's stop there for a second. Yeah. So that's happening.
Yeah.
When you see the 2 guys walk in the room, what's the first thing that goes through your mind?
Well, all the things before that was what we were most worried about, just getting it together. And I remember, you just can't make it up. I remember setting my pedal board up and I had this guitar that had an acoustic pickup in it and electric, and it all blended together. Everything set up, sound check went fine.
Right.
And I, for some reason, I'm like, I just got to check my signal one more time. I was just really in that, you know, amped up. And then something was wrong in my signal chain, and I'm so glad I did it. Those were the kind of things.
So you were playing guitar at that time, too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah.
How many songs was this show?
It was probably 6.
6 songs.
Yeah, 6 or 7.
And at the end of the 6, 7 songs, what happened?
They didn't say really anything to us. They talked with our manager, although there was an extra guy in the room, and he just wasn't the same kind of guy. But he was from Creative Artists Agency, and he loved the band.
Right.
So that was sort of what we heard. And so management did their thing, and the band's together, basically congratulating ourselves for getting through it at that point. And so I can't remember what label that was, but they eventually passed. But we did that a few more times. And just like anything, it gets a little easier as you go. But we ended up signing a deal with TVT from New York.
All right. So you signed the deal. And they put you in the studio, they put you on the road.
So most of the studio work, well, let's put it this way. There was a record that was already done.
Right.
You would think that you would either go on the road and start to do clubs as a very new band and put out what you have or redo the record.
That happens a lot.
Yeah. So our A&R team was managing a band called Default out of Canada.
Yeah.
And they had a big rock song called Wasting My Time. They basically wanted to cultivate us into another rock act. We were a rock act that had some pop songs, so we were kind of in the middle, just like Default, really.
Now that happens a lot, yeah, too. I mean, when Von Ray was on the show, they were talking about the same thing, that the label was trying to make them fit the music of the day versus going with what got them signed in the first place.
Yeah, which, from a business perspective, it makes sense to do. And we were right in the middle anyway, so we were ready to roll with whatever was going to get us to the next thing. So long story short, Rick Parisher did the Default record, and he ended up doing part of the Pay the Girl record. As I remember, my band guys might correct my history on this, but I think he had literally a 3-week window to throw some songs together. So we were clearly top priority for this, but that's the reality of it. And then in the meantime, there were some band member changes that were happening simultaneously. So now we're down to 2 guitar players and the lead singer. And that's when I transitioned to bass guitar, because I thought it'd be easier to find a better guitar player. And that was my, my entry into committing to bass full time, which was a great decision on my part.
There you go.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize that's how that came about.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you were playing guitar, were you the only guitar player?
Oh, no. We had a great lead guitar player from Cincinnati named Mark Cooper.
Okay.
Yeah. And he still plays. He plays in this area with a great band called Crown Watts, big prog band. Killer musician, killer guy. But, you know, it's like you see there was an opportunity there. to shuffle some things around, and nobody asked me to do it. I made a decision to do it. And it, again, it was one of the better decisions I've made. So we didn't really have a full band going to Seattle. And then there was a lot of, discussion as to which versions of the songs were going to be on the record.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? Depending on if it was rock radio, which was more the Rick Parisher production versus the pop stuff, which we already had, and it ended up being a mix. But you asked if they made a record or put us on tour. Well, you would think we would go do clubs.
Right. But, build up to it.
But creative artists got in touch with us and said that Shakira wanted us to go on the road with her.
That's an odd match.
It is, and it is, and it's not. So in context, she put out her crossover English record.
Okay.
And it sold 13 million copies. She was looking for a rock pop band, an English-speaking rock pop band, to basically set up her position of what she was trying to do in America. And the Creative Artists Agency had our disc in the pile, and she picked us. I mean, it was really that... that was it. So, you know, we're playing the Mad Frog in Cincinnati, which holds 300 people. And then the next thing you know, I get the tour dates for the first leg, and it's every place that you've ever dreamed of playing.
All right. Well,
yeah. And there's a lot here, Jay.
There's a lot to unpack here. So you go on the road and you're hitting every place under the sun.
Yeah. I mean, looking at the first dates, we started at the San Diego Sports Arena, which was historic. Just the experience of the tour bus pulling up to pick us up to
that's
go
what I'm
there.
Saying.
It's
you're
crazy.
You know? You're starting.
It's crazy.
You went from local regional band to signing a deal to going straight to the top.
I wouldn't even say regional. I would say local with a lot of work put into song.
Well, yeah, because at that point you weren't even playing.
Yeah, we weren't even touring. And we were getting it together thinking we would start, you know, we were still kind of finding our groove even as a band.
So how did you even get a tour bus?
Well, the record label had to make some decisions. And so here's the other crazy thing about this story is the record wasn't done. I mean, it was done, but they were making mixed decisions and mastering. And so this lined up where we had an opportunity to do this with a label budget, but the record wasn't out yet. So what do you do as the label? So clearly these are decisions made far upstream from the band.
Right.
All we heard was, do you want to go play shows? And we said, yes. How about this? We were beside ourselves. Let's be honest.
All right. Again, I mean, I know it's a band at that point and everybody is probably just dumbfounded, but you get the word, you're going on the road with Shakira and you end up playing in an arena.
Yeah.
All these things just come like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So at that point, you still feeling imposter syndrome?
I wouldn't say imposter syndrome. I think now, personally, it was like we have to learn how to do it. There is a craft to doing it. We didn't even know what the craft was, but when I talked about, you know, having guitar techs, your crew, and your small team around you, like just the logistical piece of how do you operate as a band functioning on the road? What do you do when you go in the arena? Well, you know, there's a crew that arrives hours early that puts guide tape down to your dressing room. And then, you know, you figure it out. And it was
who's providing your techs and stuff at that point?
We had our same guys. We basically used the same Blessed Union of Souls guys to go on that first tour with.
Okay.
Which made a lot of sense.
They
would
know the bigger arenas.
Yeah.
I was going to say, if you're using local guys and throwing them in an arena, that's crazy. It's way over anybody's head.
Yeah.
But no, that's cool. So how long were you on the road with Shakira?
So the commitment was for one leg, and it was, I'm going to say, 12 dates from San Diego through Chicago, Madison Square Garden, and I believe Nassau Coliseum. Philadelphia, you know, all the major markets on the first leg, which was just amazing. It was just amazing. I could just talk about this for an hour, but that first show, like getting through it was the accomplishment. We didn't get a sound check because they were setting up the production for her. And there's, you know, it's all on YouTube if you want to see what her production was like. I mean, we didn't miss a show. We watched it every night. So 12 dates. Then we went home. And then she had another opening band that was a Latin band that opened up one show on the second leg. And then she fired them and asked us to come back for a second leg. Oh. So it was Christmas again. Except now, well, the great thing about this is now is you're like, we know how to do this. We can do this. We've done this before. We're going back. Right. So it's ring up a better bus. The rider, true story, the rider got better. We didn't even ask for more stuff in the rider for the dressing room. It just magically was bigger. More of this, more of that. It was stock full of
nothing but green M&Ms.
Deli tray, you know, deli tray, water, case of imported beer, case of beer, and a bottle of Jack Daniels is what I remember. Yeah, and the bottle.
If that's what you were having every
day. That was it.
That was why that's all you can remember.
Yeah, exactly. And the bottle kept getting bigger.
That's crazy.
No, it was, but even that, you know, just those things, you know, we've never had that before. It was great.
So what did you learn from that?
Oh, well, I learned that she's an amazing entertainer. I mean, it was top to bottom. She had a lot of rock injected into her set at that time. She was playing drums. She was playing AC/DC songs. And then also, you know, we got friendly with her band, which Dan Rothschild was her bass player. He was, you know, part of Tonic. His dad was famous photographer for the Doors. And all of that crew and the band were so good to us because they knew that we were the green guys from Ohio. Right. And they would check on us in our dressing room.
Like the big brother.
It was amazing, dude. It was amazing. So again, you know, I learned a lot from the way those guys treated us.
So did you learn anything from a musical point of view?
No, we didn't really talk much about music at all. It was just more about being, you know, being the thing and just enjoying the... In a weird way, I think they kind of envied us a little bit. In a weird way, because we were these guys that are playing in their own band and playing the garden and, you know, it was our thing.
Right.
You know
what I mean? And their support for Shakira.
Yeah. And just in that weird way, I mean, they were just so... I could talk another hour just about how stories from each one of those guys and how they went out of their way for us. You know what I mean?
Give me an example.
Oh, so I'll tell you one. So there was an accountant on the tour. His name was Ian. He's an English guy. And he'd literally knock on our dressing room door every night before the show. Hey, lads, you doing all right? Then he'd come in and then he would tell us a story about a band that he had managed in the past.
All right.
Like an inside baseball story, you know. And we're talking AC/DC, early Yes, Def Leppard on the Hysteria tour. He was their tour manager. And so he would tell us about, you know, things like what happened under the stage and, you know, all the crazy stuff. And he did it just to kind of, you know, include us, I think, into the thing. And it was really great because on the last day of that tour, you know, he said goodbye and it was super cool, super sweet.
That's really cool. The band acted like big brothers and he acted like a mentor.
For sure.
That is cool. So what's the craziest thing that you saw on Shakira's side during that tour?
On Shakira's side, I think, I don't know about crazy. I remember the presence of the security team, like... Never forget, she had this, it was like a movie. The head of security was a cowboy, you know, boots. He was this guy. And then all of the, then all of his guys were these just giant, you know, 6'5" guys that were right around. And they were always around. But I mean, her ship was run really tight. You know what I mean? They were dealing with things that we weren't. We were... You know,
she was
basically
massively experienced at that point.
That, and she had, you know, endorsement parties. She had all these other things going on. But again, that was the machine of each arena, the teams that come in promoting. It was a Pepsi show. So all the things that went around with her endorsements. There were some after parties after some of the concerts.
Well, I think that's why, too, in a band like yours... You get the deal. You don't go out as the headliner because you don't have that experience yet. You have to build up to it. So you open up for somebody like that who has that experience, and then you get on the road and you do that for, like you said, a couple legs of a tour, you get your feet wet. And at that time, you're still selling records if the record's out.
If the record's out, right.
You're still selling records. You're still doing things. Did you at least have a merch table or something where you could make some money
back? I'm so glad you asked that, because I just thought of, there's so much video that we took video cameras with us and we taped a bunch of stuff. But there's this one video, if you imagine a panning of the camera of all of her merch, and it's, you know, 30 different t-shirt styles. We had one t-shirt.
One?
It's like, and our one t-shirt. And that was it.
How did that one t-shirt sell?
It did fine. It was okay. We did a lot of meet and greets after. Well, we did them after every show. So as soon as we were done, we would walk up through the arena and then meet anybody and sign for whoever wanted to come say hey. And that was a really good time.
Well, I can only imagine, too, because this was pretty much pre-social media, or
it was. It was
pre-heavy social
media. It was pre-social media, pre-smartphone.
I always say the importance of the meet and greet right now is you build your presence, you build that following. Mm-hmm. But for you then, you're still building a loyal group of fans, because eventually that record's going to come out and you want those people to support
you. And that was the idea, yeah. And so a lot of the things that we had were literally, you know, branded cards with the album art, saying new singles coming out.
Coming soon.
And that was really it. And hoping that, you know, was it a good decision to put us on that tour? It's hard to say.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't do it any differently.
No, I mean, whether the record's out or not, you still have to develop a fan base, because the record will be released. And
for sure.
It's better to release it to a fan base than it is to nobody.
Yes, that's for sure. So it was pretty mind-bending time. But once we found our stride, we had a good time.
So before you found your stride, what kind of embarrassing stories, what kind of things happened?
Oh, man. So the first night was at San Diego Sports Arena, and I remember just the butterflies of pulling in. I remember that we didn't get a sound check, and I remember the sound when the lights hit the crowd. You can't describe it to anybody. It's everything that you heard on live records plus. And then playing, I don't remember playing the show. It was just like the big blur, because it was so much adrenaline. And I was talking to my buddy Greg Braun today, who called me today, who I haven't talked to for a while.
That's because it's your birthday.
It is my birthday. It's my twin brother Adam's birthday too. Happy birthday.
That's how that works.
That is how it works. He was reminding me of what happened after that, and you know how amped up we were. And I don't remember this at all, but Freddie DeMann was Shakira's manager, and he also managed Madonna and Michael Jackson. He came to our dressing room after we were done. You know, you guys were great. You know, I'm cleaning up the language here, but whatever. and then we're just, you know, we're over the moon at this point. And then our manager came in and told us how we really played, which was not
great. It was not the same.
It was not the same message.
Same story. So you did have a manager at that time. Was that somebody assigned by the label?
No, that was our manager here from Cincinnati who got us in front of the labels. Again, we had a lot of catch up to do. We had to get ready to play that. That was our first gig in that kind of environment. And so we had to make sure that we were up to the task. And that's his job, was to get us there, whether we liked it or not, you know?
Oh, no, that's pretty cool. That's a little bit more than I thought. So I know you've gone on the road with some other people. So
yeah.
What were some of these other bands like?
So after Pay the Girl, I linked up with a band that was on MCA. Their bass player had left, moved to Nashville, got a gig playing bass for an artist named Taylor Swift.
The name sounds familiar.
And so he's been with her since. I auditioned and got his job. So thanks, Amos.
There you go.
The band's called July for Kings, Cincinnati band. Joe Hedges is the driving force behind that band and the single most talented artist I've ever met. So the goal there was, he had written another record. We did pre-production with Kirk Kelsey. He worked with Three Doors Down. I think he worked with Creed a little bit too. He came up.
That same group out of Orlando.
Yeah, that same group out of Orlando. July for Kings was managed by a company out of Bethlehem, Pennsylvania called Media 5, who was managing a band called Live and a band called Fuel. And so, yeah, July.
Two great bands.
Two great bands. Two great rock bands.
Same time as Von Ray, Matchbox 20, Sister Hazel.
Exactly. Yeah. So the idea was we're going to showcase again. So got it together, did a lot of East Coast runs with them between Cincinnati and New York City and everywhere in between. Did a few showcases in New York, CBGBs.
You know? Yeah.
Didn't get a bite.
All right. So what was your next step?
So after that, I left July for Kings and basically took a little downtime and then linked up with a friend of mine. His name's Aaron Chowcraft, and he lives in Columbus, Ohio. He's a singer-songwriter. We basically put a band together with a couple of the guys from Pay the Girl, Greg Brown on drums, Mark Cooper on guitar, and built a cover at an original band and played in Columbus for, I think, 8 years, just doing clubs and things. Ended up doing a record up there.
No, wait a minute. Yeah, I got a question for you. This happens a lot. I just want to know what it was like for you from going on the road, playing big arenas and big gigs, to then going back and playing club gigs. Was it oddly comforting?
It was. In my mind, playing is playing.
Right.
And I really believe that, regardless if it's huge or a small thing. It's really about the band and the guys. If the guys are great and the band is good and good getting better, like that's all I really am concerned about. But to say that we didn't want to play larger places would be a lie.
Right, so, of course.
Yeah. I mean, we had great times playing those rock gigs around Columbus and, you know, I guess.
Well, Columbus had a great circuit.
Yeah.
Mean, that was great places. I remember when I was over in Chillicothe, we recorded so many bands out of Columbus. It was crazy.
Yeah. And Columbus still has good artists running around town. We made another record in Sonic Lounge Studios up there. The band was called Introspect. All this music.
What kind of studio was that?
It was a church converted into a studio, and it has the Neve console from.
So very
Olympic.
Similar to Ocean Way. Ocean Way in Nashville, a big church that was converted into a studio and has the Neve console.
It had a great room, control room, and then two small editing rooms. So it wasn't huge. Amazing studio owned and run by Joe Viers. I'll record there any day that I get a chance. It's a great place to go. And we did that. And I guess moving along from that, that band dissolved, but Aaron Chowcraft, the singer of that band, and I started to really hunker down and write songs. And that birthed basically a project that we have called Big Mood. We have 6 songs recorded and waiting on final mixes to come back. And we'll release that this year. And I'm really excited about that.
All right. Well, you brought it up, so let's discuss it. You're writing these songs. It looks like it's going to be an EP to kick things off. Let's start with the end goal first. What's the goal of the EP? Are you looking for another record deal?
No, I don't necessarily think so. It's really not about that for us now. For me personally, it's about growing as a songwriter, doing music that I want to do and not necessarily what other artists want to do that I'm playing with. And I think that's the real difference now. And I get a lot of satisfaction out of that. And Aaron has the same direction. So we're really matched and running in parallel on that. We have a band of our friends that we use to track their record, along with our mix engineer who played some guitar. He's a wonderful guitar player. But we'll put a band together and we'll do some shows to support it. But it's really just about growth as a songwriter, making the best record we can, something that expresses our identity of where we are now. I mean, there's always a little bit of legacy involved in that. So you want to continue to build and grow. And I think that's where we are.
What's your songwriting process like?
So generally for me, it's always an acoustic guitar and a melody. Its lyrics usually come last. And then I'll dump it in Logic.
I won't hold that against you.
Yeah, I know you won't. I knew I'd get the stare. And sometimes I'll map out, you know, an entire arrangement. I'll have concepts and I'll send it to Aaron. And then he'll send me pretty fully realized ideas, acoustic and vocal. And then we'll get together and then we'll really start fleshing out. Most of the stuff comes quickly.
Right.
And I think the good ones do. The good songs generally do. Some are the hammer nail kind of thing. But
do you ever just wake up with one?
All the time. yeah.
So what's your process there? Do you have a notepad or a recorder by the bed?
It's always the phone. It's always right to the phone. Okay. And I mean, I've literally, you know, it's kind of cliche to say, but I've literally gotten up start to finish and spelled out everything.
I've been there.
It's really wild.
There. I used to keep a notebook by the bed. I used to keep a recorder. Now I got the phone. I mean, always have something right next to the bed ready to go because I wake up with ideas all the time.
And I think it's, I think that's, for lack of a better metaphor, it's a muscle that you work, and the more you work it, the more ideas start to come. And if you're, you know, in tune with just the process of writing, ideas will come, and you learn not to ignore ideas just because in the moment you think they're bad. So if they come, write them down. And then a lot of those ideas come useful later. And we're at the point now where we have so many song ideas, it's really whittling down, like, what are we going to do? Which ones do we take? And, you know, what songs mean the most to us right now? And,
you know, well, you've got a good amount of songs right now, and you got to whittle it down to five or six songs.
Yeah.
So I know you've been demoing these songs, but is there a plan to go in and do more of a full production?
Yeah. So we have five fully produced songs that are going to be on our EP, and we're going to go in soon because those are in the mixing phase now. And yeah, we have had discussions. We're ready to go in and do the next batch. And it's really just about which ones that we...
So the first batch is already being mixed. The second batch is
about to be
pre-production.
Yeah, exactly.
Gotcha. Now that that's coming together, are you assembling the final band so you can start playing shows?
So we've started the conversations of what that's going to look like. Yeah. We haven't put it together yet, but it will be coming soon.
Okay.
Yeah. And he's an amazing singer. He's one of my favorite singers on the planet. He's just got that thing. His voice has all of the elements of rock and Southern rock and blues and singer-songwriter stuff that I love. So
is that the overall feel of this project?
It's definitely in the middle of like Americana, R&B, and Southern rock. If it has riffs and harmonies, it's for me. That's it. And I think, you know, a lot of that is formed when I was talking about listening to records with my brother back in the day. When I look at a through line from the very first records that we had listened to as kids to when we got my mom brought home a Kiss album one day because she thought we'd love the cover. She got it at a garage sale for 25 cents. And we loved it, you know what I mean?
Of course.
But the through line is those things between Yes, Steely Dan, Kiss, you know, it's riffs, harmonies, and the Eagles.
Major differences.
But there's a lot of similarities too, you know what I mean? You take Reelin' in the Years, that's great riff, killer harmonies on the vocals, on the choruses. Like, there's the through line. Those are the things that I like to go after.
So. Yeah, but if you compare that to Kiss, I mean, that's quite a difference. I mean, Steely Dan, quite a difference from Kiss.
Well, I guess I'm thinking of the earlier Steely Dan, the more straightforward stuff, because that was basically the first Steely Dan.
It's still not Kiss.
Nobody's kissed Jay, and nobody ever will be.
give it a few more years, and there'll be a whole nother Kiss. Mark my words.
I don't disagree with you there. I think they're going to be. I think they're going to be robots. and I'll buy the ticket. Let's get that out there right now.
Well, yeah. I know I joke about it a lot, but Kiss is one of those bands, because of the makeup and because of everything they've done, there is no reason why they can't just keep putting another group of musicians in there.
Yeah.
And you still have the band playing and they can just keep progressing. And
honestly,
so
I think they should. I think they should do that.
Well, it's a show now more than it is a band.
Yeah. They've built these characters. They built this universe. It's an amazing accomplishment.
Let's talk about that for a minute. So, I mean, you got Kiss, you got Steely Dan, the Eagles. I mean, are those the main inspirations at this point?
For me personally, it's the vocal harmonization and melody of the Eagles.
So, yeah, that would be Eagles for sure.
Definitely that. Kiss is about just sort of the attitude, I guess.
Attitude and show.
You know what I mean? It's the attitude for sure. Steely Dan is just
perfection.
It's just always been there. You know what I mean? For lack of a better term, it's so musical, but it's so quirky. It's very unique, you know.
But they focused on perfection.
They did. And especially in the later albums. And they were, you know, they were a songwriting duo doing the same thing. to
we get a lot of people like that too.
which I can understand. But I also like my, you know, I like my Southern rock, my Southern rock feel.
So who's your Southern rock influences?
Definitely the Black Crowes and every offshoot of that band. Good Georgia band. One of the best singers, rock and roll singers that ever did it, in my opinion. And the reason is because, you know, they're amazing riffs, amazing grooves. And
that's a little newer than I expected you to go.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I honestly think they're a better culmination of all of those styles than even, I'm going to say, like even some of the early, you know, Southern rock bands like Black Oak Arkansas, Blackfoot, and all those other bands. I mean, they're cool. But
what about 38 Special?
38 Special is great. They have great songs. I'm not going to knock on the Special at all. But I just think the Crowes do it better, and they have a little more variety and throughout their catalog. Little Feet stylings, there's Joe Cocker stylings. They're kind of an amalgamation of all of those things.
38 Special is more commercial. I mean, if you can call Southern rock commercial, but yeah,
I think
Caught Up in You and all those songs.
Oh, yeah, amazing hooks, amazing guitar.
Where Black Crowes to me are just a little bit more musical. Mm-hmm. You know, they stretch it a little bit further. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they've been one of my favorite bands. They're my go-to. You know, when they go play live, I try to make sure I go see them. Aaron and I had the pleasure of warming up for Rich Robinson, the guitar player, who had he was out with his solo band. It was a club in Columbus. He and I opened up as an acoustic duo, and Rich was playing that night. And Aaron found the tour manager and said, "Hey, can we just meet Rich? Because I really wanted to." And they said, "Sure." Took us backstage, and he couldn't have been a nicer guy. And he took us into the dressing room, introduced us to the band. And Sven Pippian from the Black Crowes was in the band. I had no idea that he was going to be there. Took us around the room, introduced us to everybody. And then that band became a band called the Magpie Salute, which recorded by a guy named Sean Janoki, who is mixing the Big Mood record. So kind of goes full circle. We got a hold of him, started trading songs, and lo and behold, there it is. So we're waiting to get those mixes back and get it out in the world.
All right. Sure. What was it like opening for Aaron Lewis?
Oh, yeah, Aaron Lewis. That was a gig. I was playing bass from a Cincinnati country artist. We were out doing support there. It was in Iowa. It was Aaron Lewis, and he had his backing band. It was at a casino. You know, I've known of Stained, Aaron Lewis's rock band.
My wife's favorite.
Yeah, and I knew of his country songwriting. Mm-hmm. What I saw on that show was how much his fan base loved what he was doing. You know what I mean? So it was great to see that connection in front of you, because you weren't hearing him on the radio. He played his country songs, and he had a killer band, all nice dudes. And then his encores were the Stain songs.
Stain songs.
Acoustic, broken down. So the power of the song, man. And those were his to play. And that was a great night, and the audience loved it.
I took the wife to see Stain just a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, outdoors at the Hard Rock Casino in Cincinnati. And it was a good show. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little different being outside versus an arena. So it had a different type of vibe to it, but it was still a good show. Sure.
Yeah, I like that venue. Summertime, you know, they get good rock bands down there, and you just kind of go hang out and do the summer thing.
Yeah. All right, sir. Well, we do this thing here we call Unsung Heroes, where we take a moment to shine the light on somebody who doesn't typically get the light shined on them, somebody who works behind the scenes, or maybe a family member who's supported you in the past. Do you have anybody you'd like to shine a little light on?
I think we're both smart men, and we should thank our wives and our children. What does Steve Perry say? Loving a music man ain't always what it's supposed to be.
There you go.
He's gone all the
quote
time.
From my favorite song.
Or whatever. An amazing song. I think we'd start there. And I also think my twin brother, Adam, because I can say without having him to sort of develop all of these ideas and opinions, and he was the first guy to show recording.
It's like having he was sort of know, the, he two was, people to do the work.
It really is. It's also someone that makes
I need a twin.
You do need it. Everybody needs a twin, because when you think you're a little crazy and you got the guy next to you doing the same thing, you're like, I'm all right. I'm not the only one. And that's literally it. Yeah, I'll give some love to him too.
Let's give a big thanks to Drew for taking the time to share his stories with us tonight. And thank you for taking the time to hang with me here. I really do appreciate it. If you could, please follow, share, and connect on all the socials. I would love to hear from you. You can do that and find the links to everything mentioned over at jfranzi.com/episode42. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Jay Franzi Show. Make sure you visit us at jfranzi.com. Follow, connect, and say hello. This episode has been brought to you by VR Knives, your source for 100% custom knives made by a true rock star. So, if you're in the market for a new piece of art, reach out to VR Knives. 407-421-5528. 407-421-5528.